Never been at these meetings before. I frequent economics meetings, government, USDA kinds of meetings, and I like you all a whole lot better because you're interested more in the outcomes and the impact rather than being lost in the econometrics. So wicked problems. I didn't make that up. That's something that my complexity economics colleagues talk about. But obesity is a wicked problem. And any of the major frameworks that you can use to look at it, behavioral, environmental, biological, all fail to capture a complete picture. The problem is taking a systems approach can lead to pleasing no one. And that I realized pretty quickly when you try and publish across different disciplines. So I'd like you to please think transdisciplinary, think that many disciplines have something to add, and we should take an approach based on the problem and not our disciplines. So I don't need to tell you about the growing obesity problem around the world. It is spreading from the U.S. Throughout the globe, and it doesn't look like it's going to change soon. I think what might be interesting is to superimpose on our dietary guidelines and my plate, and that was a really good segue into some of the things that I'm going to talk about, conspicuously absent from the United States dietary guidelines are statements like enjoy your food, enjoy meals, happy eating makes for happy family life. A happy family is when family members eat together. And food plus joy equals health. We don't tend to see that anywhere in our dietary guidelines. Just keep it in mind for later on. So we know that a complex array of variables lead to obesity. My colleague Dranowski always likes to say it's because people are poor. Well, I'm an economist, and I know that if you just give poor people money, it's not going to change the situation. Why do poorer people have a higher incidence of obesity? Of course, we know it's a consumption of highly energy dense foods. We know that there is links between time spent preparing meals and eating meals. In addition, where people eat, how frequently they eat, and how much time they spend eating. So now we're already going across disciplines of nutrition, economics, consumer behavior, to say the least. But an examination of these complex relationships has been limited by both data availability and disciplinary focus. We have been unable to find one data set that can allow us to look at all of these things in a transdisciplinary manner. So we first suggested linking data across the American Time Use Survey, the American Time Use Survey's Eating and Health module, and the Consumer Expenditure Survey. Now, right away, we have problems because expenditures aren't intake, as my nutritionist friends always like to inform me and to chastise me. You can't just use expenditures. But people are obviously eating things that they purchase, so we're going to start with the Consumer Expenditure Survey. We have looked at the NHANES, and I presented those findings, my preliminary findings, linking the American Time Use Survey with the NHANES data set this summer at the American Time Use Conference that was in Maryland. And as an economist, I think that the NHANES has just as many problems. What we found were obese people were only reporting eating 1,700 calories a day. And I think, so we have problems across the data sets. So one of my goals later on in life is to look at the differences when you link time use with expenditures, and then what do you get when you link the other two data sets, the NHANES and the ATUS as well. But we're not there yet. So, possible contributions of this work: transdisciplinary, making a better data set, and looking at structural equation modeling, in other words, the endogenous relationship of, in this particular case, food venue, which allows us to look at direct and indirect effects on obesity. So the Consumer Expenditure Survey has been available yearly since 1984 from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, where food was purchased and expenditures on food, but there's no information on height, weight, or obesity. My grad student and then research associate, Amanda Goldstein, we just published a paper in obesity linking ATUS with CEX data. The American Time Use Survey, also conducted by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, Respondents report activities they did between 4 a.m. on the day before the interview until 4 a.m. on the day of the interview. And between 2006 and 2009, height and weight information were collected as part of the eating and health module. Now, it's hard enough to link up the ATUS data with the current population survey, which gets the demographic characteristics with the eating and health module, never mind then trying to connect it to a totally unrelated data set, consumer expenditure survey. So how did we do that? Well, we used cell matching techniques in this particular case, where the consumer expenditure average cell means for food spent were tied to ATUS individual data based on demographic characteristics of family composition, gender, and income. So those were only three. And we end up with over 19,000 people in our final sample. So it has a lot of external validity and is population based. When we're using the NHANES data, we are using propensity matching techniques, which, you know, cell matching, propensity matching, they're just two different techniques, each that have their positives and negatives. So we split the sample by gender, looking at men and women separately. It became clear pretty quickly that when you're looking at time use and eating behavior, that men and women are not the same population. My economist friends just want me to throw in a dummy variable for men and women. And we said, no, they are two separate populations. The dietary guidelines for Americans are grouped by gender and also age. Now, in our work, in our the study that was published in Obesity, we did it for single women aged, I think it was the 30 to 49 age category. But in this study, we've just separated it by gender and included a trend for age. Pregnant, underweight, and super morbidly obese have their own issues, and they were omitted from the data set. So step one. We ran a series of reduced form regressions to predict whether an individual is in the lowest quartile for fast food and full service food or the highest quartile for food at home. Now, of course, we've got some hypotheses there that food away from home could be contributing to the obesity epidemic, and eating at home could in some way perhaps mitigate that. So we estimated the lowest quartile for fast food and full service and the highest quartile for food at home. And this is just one of many tables, which I'm not going to concentrate on. Here you can see at a glance that for men and women and across the food venues, it's different, that we get different estimates. And the most consistent estimates that are significant for both men and women look like education, two adult households with children, food expenditures. And these were very significant overall predictions, but individual characteristics were not consistent across men and women, nor for food venue. So step two, estimation. Because where you eat is endogenous or a dependent variable, we have to estimate that first before we can estimate what the effect is on obesity. We use the method of truncated regression, which is a variation of a Tobit model, where we first estimate the probability of overweight. And then, so we say, are you overweight versus not overweight, and predict that. And then we estimate BMI as a continuous variable, but separately for healthy BMI people, overweight BMI people, and people with obese BMIs. And what we found in a lot of the literature was that some researchers will just put in BMI from 18 to 50. And what we found was that people, the impact on BMI is different whether you're within the healthy weight range, the overweight range, or the obese range. So we treated them as three separate subcategories. We included interaction effects for venue, primary cook, and time spent cooking. And I could talk about a lot of different results ranging from the demographics and so on, but for this particular talk, I'd like to concentrate on venue, cooking, and time spent cooking, and time spent eating. Once again, here you have a bunch of output that doesn't make much sense in the large frame of things. But when you look, just looking at some selected variables, time spent eating, where significant is negative, and is negative across the board. That would be what's in red. The bold black, time spent in secondary eating, is negative across the board, and where significant, it's also negative. Screen time, positive across the board, except for healthy weight men. Active time, negative across the board, except for healthy weight men. And I love to say this little tidbit here, in that I always hear some of my male colleagues say, well, I'm not fat, my BMI is high because I'm so muscular. And so if you look at sedentary time or time spent in front of a screen, healthy weight, you know, this really does show that if you're a male and you spend a lot of sedentary time, maybe your BMI is lower when you're a healthy weight, and when you spend more active time, it's higher. But it's negative across the board for everyone else. The interaction terms, the last three rows, are very interesting. We try to get at the idea of food compensation or uncompensation, so that if you are in the lowest quartile for eating full-service food away from home and the highest quartile for eating food at home, so you eat a lot of food at home and not a lot at a full-service restaurant, we see that for most of those coefficients are negative on overweight and your BMI. If you eat less fast food, the lowest quartile of fast food and the highest quartile of food at home, we see the same trend. So it seems like there are people who are compensating for eating at home and eating away from home. Now we have to compute, because we have these interaction effects, we have to actually compute the effect of being in those lowest quartiles, being the primary cook and having time spent in food preparation. And so where you see the most crosses there, those are the most significant results because they were computed from a lot of the different variables. So within the healthy range, I'll just concentrate on women here because we're going to run out of time quickly. For women in the healthy weight range, eating less food at full service and fast food restaurants decreases their BMI by a lot within that 18 to 25 range. And for eating at home, also a large significant value. Time spent in food preparation actually decreases BMI for overweight women and men, but increases it in the obese range. And being the primary cook in the family, it's quite interesting, decreases BMI for both overweight and obese women once they're already overweight, and decreases the probability of or decreases BMI for healthy weight men. So this is what the whole model looks like, and it looks very complicated, and this is just for the probability of overweight for women. So there is a model like this for the probability of overweight and those three BMI calculations for both men and women. So there are eight of these. But just to show you, this is the prize in this particular estimation. It's the probability of overweight. And these are all the variables that were significant in leading to that probability. Here we have the predicted food venues. Here we have non-modifiable risk factors and poor health. And you know, later on in the next step is to look at the circular effect of health on obesity and then its feedback, obesity on poor health. So we have non-modifiable risk factors that are all significant. We have demographics that were all significant. And then we have some of those food behaviors, primary cook, food expenditures, and time spent secondary eating that were all significant. But rather than focus on every single one of these results here, and there are so many of them, I thought we would just focus on loud and clear results. Eating at home seems to have a mitigating effect on BMI for overweight individuals, especially women. And this is in a transdisciplinary complex system model controlling for a lot of other factors. The healthy weight cohort spends more time eating and drinking. Brian Wansink's idea of mindful eating. Sedentary individuals have both a higher probability of overweight and higher BMIs once overweight, and that's measured by all types of screen time. Active individuals have a lower BMI if overweight and lower probability of overweight, especially men. You might say, duh, but here we go. You've got to have the evidence in a population-based study. And overweight respondents who report poor health status have higher BMIs. So what about these select indirect effect? Education seems to decrease the probability of spending on fast food, which decreases BMI for both men and women. Men below 135% of the poverty line spent less on food at home, thus increasing BMI. Women above 185% of the poverty line spend less on food away from home, both fast food and restaurants, decreasing BMI in healthy weight and overweight individuals. Urban women eat more fast food, leading to an increased probability of overweight, controlling for everything else, while urban men eat at home less, a factor shown to decrease the probability of overweight. Men who are the primary cook are much less likely to be in the top quartile for food at home. This is very interesting, leading to an increased probability of overweight. Some worrisome trends. For both men and women, being in a household with two adults and children decreased your probability of being in the lowest quartile for fast food and full service restaurants. You're busy, you've got kids, you're eating out more. For women, it also decreased the probability of being in the top quartile for food at home. Uh-oh, eating out more. These factors increased both the probability of overweight and BMI. The question is, are we conditioning our children to the same fate? So what? Well, I think that linking multiple population-based data sets obtains a richer set of variables with which to analyze the factor that contribute to weight. And for both men and women, variables that impact the probability of being overweight and that predict BMI differ in significance, magnitude, and in some cases, direction of effect. Now, this is where I take a big gulp. When I was in college, I was in school of home economics, my nutrition degree, and we fought hard to disassociate ourselves from being home economists. That was the last thing we wanted to be. But guess what? Perhaps we need to facilitate at-home meal preparation and eating. We need to teach people how to cook. That has to come back. Kids that can't put three simple ingredients together to produce something. Increased labeling requirements. If we are eating away from home, at least let's make people aware. There are those that say it doesn't matter. Well, but it's there. It's going to take time. It's one tool in a whole kit of techniques. Moderate your number of meals away from home. I mean, I'm older than a lot of you in the audience, but it used to be a treat, and now it can be a three-time-a-day experience. Include in food enjoyment in our dietary guidelines. Spend more time eating and eat more often. And target recommendations to genders. Active time seems to have a greater impact on men, while where you eat, how slow you eat, and how often you eat seem to impact women more. As I said, we hope to continue this work with the NHANES, and we actually have the NHANES. The problem is, when you're trying to link the data sets and do propensity matching, you have to be there, because they won't give us some of those variables that CDC says that will reveal respondents, like what area of the country do you live in. And so you have to be there, and even if you go there to estimate the data set, they won't let you take the data set home. Examine obesity as a wicked problem and understand the endogenous effects of poor health and obesity, activity level obesity, and screen time. And where are the leverage points, and what are the circular things that are happening, and do these feedback mechanisms work? And complexity economics allows us to do that.